It's a great privilege to speak with musicians of our time who have steeped themselves in the lives of musicians who've come before them. We have one of those gentlemen with us today, Sir John Eliot Gardiner, the great conductor of all kinds of music, but he has reached into a deep, deep space for his latest creation, a book called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. It's published by Knopf, just out. Sir John Eliot, welcome to WQXR once again.
Thank you.
It's a great privilege to talk to you. Tell me, this is a substantial tome, some 600 pages. Why did you see a need for a new book about Bach? What hasn't been said about him that you wanted to tell us?
Well, it's certainly not a standard life and works. There have been plenty of those, and a lot of them are very, very fine. What seemed to be missing was a convincing correlation between the little we know about him as a man and the huge amount that we think we might know about him from the music. And is this just a purely subjective transfer, or is there really a connection? What can be said that's not just gobbledygook?
In other words, was Bach as great at his music, or was he just a guy on whom some great pile of talent fell?
Exactly. And the whole nature versus nurture debate, which doesn't get us very, very far in Bach's case. I mean, the problem is this, and it's symptomized by the fact that I grew up under the portrait of the Hausmann's portrait of Bach, that there is a forbidding, bewigged, rather jowly.
He looks awfully stern and German.
Stern and German. He could be a politician, couldn't he? And there is the music that I was learning as a kid when I first saw that portrait, which didn't seem to emanate from underneath that wig at all. It was joyous. It was dance-imbued. It was full of spirit. It was complex, but it was life-affirming. Now, how was one to make some kind of connection or between these two apparently contradictory positions? So I suppose it really came out of the year that I spent doing the Bach cantatas, all of them in a single year in 2000, when simply by the intensity and depth of that experience and almost solitary confinement with a single man's brain, that one started to feel that there were connections between the writing of the music and the exposure of his personality. And I turned it over a great deal and I thought, you know, is this really worth exploring? And in the end, I mean, I fundamentally believe that writing about music is a mug's game. It can't be done. You're only using metaphor and you're using language which is imprecise by definition to describe something that is incredibly precise, music, but ephemeral. How do you do it? And especially if you're told you can't use any music examples, which I was told when I set out to do this. So what I tried to do was to approach him, as it were, from 14 different aspects, 14 being the magic number in Bach, B-A-C-H, which adds up to 14 in the numerology of the day. Different perspectives, different spokes, all concentrated on the same hub, starting really with the context of Germany at that critical moment, emerging from a terrible war, the 30 Years' War, and trying to recover economically and spiritually at the same time. A great new efflorescence of Lutheranism, but torn in two different directions by a pietist wing, by an orthodox wing, and then the Enlightenment and the new scientific revolution of the 17th century also impinging. So you've got so many tensions. It's a fascinating time. And there's a strong conclusion that I came to, which is that Bach's output and his particular way of expressing himself in music could only have happened at that time, in that place. You know, 10, 15 years later, it wouldn't have worked. I think the Enlightenment would have shut him out. The Lutheran tradition had almost run its course at that stage, and it very nearly had him, in any case, on toast, because he was so buffeted around by the conflicts within Leipzig, within the town council, and the quarrels within the clergy, the fact that the town was divided between a right wing who were very much absolutist and therefore doffing the cap towards the elector in Dresden, and a much more kind of bourgeois socialist ethic, which was that we wanted teaching, we wanted to look after the poor, we wanted philanthropy, and we really don't need a lot of music for that.
So it's very much like our own time.
Very much like our own time. And that's even more brought out by the circumstances of his schooling that I was able to uncover. It wasn't original on my side. There's been research into this going back to the 1920s, but somehow it's been sanitized, and all the major biographies of Bach of the 20th century have really omitted it. But the facts are that, first of all, that Bach played truant at school. He was absent a heck of a lot of the time. Secondly, that the situation in the schooling of his day was chaotic. There was the usual things: shortage of textbooks, overcrowding, nowhere to let off steam in the playground, as it were. All things that are very, very common today, but also some nasty aspects of it. Proto-hooliganism, guys lobbing bricks through windows, chasing the girls, coming to school with daggers, with swords. A particularly nasty cantor who was Bach's schoolmaster, formmaster, was a sadist and eventually got outed and evicted from the school. But
and run out of town.
Who knows what kind of damage he may have perpetrated on Bach and so on? It's all circumstantial. It's not direct. I can't say Bach was bullied, was violated, was abused, and I can't say that. But you can say that the conditions pertaining to education were nothing like what you'd expect
to produce
the greatest musician of his day or of any day.
I'm fascinated by what you've just posited. So that argues against that occasionally a genius is dropped among us at random. He has to be dropped at the right place at the right time.
Absolutely, in that particular murky situation.
That's amazing. Now, do you conclude from your look at the educational world in which Bach grew up that he may have engaged in some hooliganism, but he was not a hooligan himself? Or was he just a young man reacting to the pressures of his time? He had no parents, for heaven's sakes. He was being raised by his brother.
Well, this is where you can get into an awful lot of stupid speculation. I mean, you can make lots of psychological kind of...
The temptation's tremendous to do that.
It is. I think, look, what we can say quite clearly is that yes, he was orphaned at age 9, somehow or other, that changed his life. That's the least we can say. Suddenly, his grades at school improved. He went to live with his elder brother, and he became a swot. He really, really worked. We also know that he got very precocious musical education from his elder brother, something used to be denied. Because, parallel to all the stuff that I've been trying to elucidate from the music, there's been the research going on by amazing musicologist sleuths in the Bach archive in Leipzig. And they came up, for instance, in the last 5 years with this discovery of two bits of manuscript which are written in tablature by Bach, which show that he was able to master tablature, which is very, very difficult, organ tablature, which is kind of type of shorthand.
Organ tablature?
Yeah.
Lute, yes. Other kinds, maybe?
Well, organ tablature was a very sophisticated way of writing complex organ music down in shorthand. And not many people were doing it in Bach's day. It had been forgotten. But he was doing it. He'd been taught it by, first of all, his elder brother, and then by a guy called Georg Böhm, whom he studied with in Lüneburg, though he never admitted that he did. And there is Bach, age 13 and then 15, transcribing two of the hardest pieces that have been written for the organ, one by Reinken, one by Buxtehude, who were the real top composers of the day, which suggests, number one, that he was pretty smart to be able to do that. Number two, that he could have mastered this, that he could have played this stuff. So, if he had been a hooligan, if he had been a complete a second-class scholar, at school, by this time, he was really focused already on his music, and he was on the ladder. But the next thing that we discover is that he sang in the choirs, the school choirs that busked, that went out to earn their living or to earn for their schooling by singing in the streets. And in nearly all the towns that he worked in, there were at least two choirs, and they used to have gang warfare between the different areas of the town that they carved up between them.
So the Jets and the Sharks and Choir
Rogues. The Jets and the Sharks,
Rogues.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was pretty severe. They had to call in the army at one stage to sort them out. And, Bach was subject to this tension. So that goes on, and oh, fine. You think, well, that's all interesting, but it doesn't prove anything. And then we come to the proof. Here he is, aged 18, in his first job, catapulted into a situation which was, in a way, wonderfully favourable to him. He'd become organist of the Third Church in Arnstadt, which was a kind of stamping ground of the Bachs. And he was put in charge of a choir of senior students. They were all older than him. And he started to write music for them. And in one case, he wrote an extremely difficult bassoon obbligato. And the guy who played it obviously couldn't cope with it and made a hash of it. And Bach, being impatient, called him with a swear word. And the guy was furious and tried to get his revenge. And then there is an incident, and it's all well documented. With a sword, and he attacked Bach on the way back. And Bach defended himself with a sword and had to be separated by all the onlookers, and then went to the consistory and say, listen, I think I've been badly treated, and the consistory sided with the guy who had attacked him, and so on. And I think it sets a pattern for a disgruntlement that happens all through his life. Whenever he's up against authority, he has a problem with anger management, and he has a problem with authority.
That explains a lot of his difficulties with the Leipzig Town Council.
Indeed.
And how does it move into his family life then? Bach seems to have been... Well, he was prolific in creation of children, but partly by virtue of the fact that his first wife died very suddenly, with him out of town, buried in 24 hours. We don't know very much about that. And yet, he seems to have been a very good father, concerned with his children's education, his son's education. He had a son who may have been disabled, and he did the best he could for that young man as well. So if the guy had a problem with authority, it didn't mean that he didn't have a warm heart. And that certainly is shown in his music, too.
Absolutely, you're so right. It's a parallel series of lines that run right through his career, that on the one hand, there's somebody who is very collegial, that any musician who comes to town, he will entertain, he will always treat with respect. His house is a dovecot, described by Carl-Philipp Emanuel, of activity, musical activity, and there's always, and there right to the last days is he copying out music of really insignificant composers, because his ethic of self-improvement required him to transcribe all this music. That's all fine. Respect for his colleagues. Also respect for, and more than that, a real sort of paterfamilias attitude towards his children, to make sure not only that they were educated musically, but that they were placed in proper employment wherever he could. And it grieved him terribly. Those are the few family letters we have. When one of his sons goes, Halli Dalali, he goes AWOL and doesn't pay his debts. Very interesting. Bach says, I'm not paying the debts until you found my son. And he disappears and dies early. So there's that conflict. But then you've also got this cantankerous and almost irresponsible side of him, when he picks fights quite unnecessarily. I mean, right at the end of his life, when he really could have been, he was already diabetic and probably losing his sight, and the last thing he needed really was another fight. He picks a fight not even on his own home patch with somebody, a headmaster of a school several miles away, who has been laying down the law about music being irrelevant to the curriculum, and that everything should be pedagogically correct, and that music should be marginalized. And Bach gets himself involved and writes an article, or gets a pupil to write an article on his behalf, where he makes a pun on the war, on the word Rektor, which means headmaster in German, and calls him Dreckohr, which means dirty ear. I mean, it's schoolboy stuff. It's ridiculous.
And he can't stop himself from doing it.
He can't stop himself from doing it.
The discoveries that you've made in the course of writing this book and learning about Bach, what have they changed about the way that you make his music?
I think it was more the experience of conducting all the cantatas back to back on the appropriate occasion for which they were written, all through a single year, that influenced me more than the writing of the book in the first place, because that puts so much focus on the whole fascination that there is between music and language when they're put together. Music is not always compliant as a handmaiden of language. It has its own agenda, and it can either be complicit with the thoughts, with the theology, or it can be in conflict with it. I call it collusion and collision in my book, and that is a fascinating topic for me, because it it suggests that Bach was not just simply a card-carrying Lutheran who just complied, but that he had his own struggles, that he had his own views, his own very strong subversive views. But like any musician, I mean, the immediate example that comes to mind is Shostakovich. You can't pin it on him. You can't say those were his Stalinist views, anti-Stalinist views, because music is by definition ephemeral. And any cleric coming up to Bach and saying you're going against the church, you say, what do you mean? I'm setting the text. I'm doing exactly the same. Even if the music seems to be saying something different.
But you're persuaded then by this, now I see the answer to the question is that your immersion in Bach's music affected your
writing.
View of the person.
Absolutely.
And so what you're saying is that there's Bach the individual all over this work that fits right into the Lutheran liturgy.
Absolutely.
What should we now think about this man who we have so much of his music and so much of his expression, and yet the guy remains somewhat elusive? You have given us great insights into him, but I think you're asking us just to see him more as a full human being or a human being with particular flaws. Who is the guy you're introducing us to now?
Somebody who's much closer to us and to our day than we might think if we just listen to the Art of Fugue or to the Musical Offering. Not a remote genius, and no necessary correlation between a great man and a great music. There is the possibility in all of us, I think that's a conclusion, that despite all our flaws, despite our frailties, to overcome that if we can tap into the talent that is given to us. I'm not saying that we can all have the capacity to be of the greatness of Bach. Of course not. That he is unique and utterly exceptional in that. But I think it gets away from the old myth that great music has to emerge from a great human being. And beyond that, that actually the things that some of the attributes that make Bach's music so great spring from the fact that he was a flawed individual with a huge heart and huge humanity, huge compassion, particularly for those who are grieving and those who are in difficulty with their personal circumstances, their faith, and that's the hallmark of his music, of his vocal music. It may not be the hallmark of the well-tempered clavier, but it's certainly the hallmark of the B minor Mass, the two Passions, and the cantatas.
I would argue that it speaks to the well-tempered clavier too. This is a guy who's trying to bring unity to a very divisive area of musical theory at the time, which is how the heck do we tune a scale in order to make music? And Bach says, if we work it out in this way, we can play everything and go all kinds of places.
Absolutely. And we're not into equal temperament.
That's
we're
right.
into well-tempered.
That's right. That's right. I observe, Sir John Eliot, that you have found greater compassion for this man, not that you didn't have it before, but you have found that his ethic of compassion suffuses his music, and that is something that we can take with us every day in our time.
Absolutely.
I should have made you say it, but I...
No, I like the way you said it. It was very, very nice. Can I just add one thing?
Please.
If we could just go back to the portrait, the famous Hausmann portrait.
Yeah.
You know, the forbidding eyes and yet the sensual mouth. Just take a look at what he's holding in his hand. He's got that piece of manuscript in his hand, and it's a canon, and he says it's a canon, a six-part canon, a triplex, which means that it's the three subjects going on. And here we're looking at him holding that canon, and we think, what's going on here? There are only three lines of music. Where's the sixth part? Where are the others? And then you think, hang on a minute. What about from his perspective? He's looking down on it too. Now, what he reads doesn't read from our perspective left to right. It writes right to left. And there's a pentimento, a little slither of manuscript that's added on the Hausmann portrait. And you can see that it's added because the color of his coat is grinning through. And in the corner of that is a different clef, a tenor clef. So it suggests that Bach is saying to you, okay, you read it your way in the alto clef, fine. I'm reading it a different way, in a different direction. And actually, to help you, there's a tenor clef. put them together and you find a piece of six-part counterpoint. And I think that's so emblematic. It's so symptomatic of the man saying you have to look deeper all the time. You have to look beyond the surface. And it's not just the surface of all our flaws and all our weaknesses and so on. Actually, there's a profundity in the human being, in the human psyche, in the human creativity, which can produce something that is, in a sense, godlike.
The book, published by Knopf, is Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. The author, Sir John Eliot Gardner. A privilege to talk to you, as always, sir.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.